Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
With the baby in the deep, when my blood runs cold, and the baby in the deep. My blood runs cold, and the baby in the deep.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Brad Williams fronts the Salty Dogs, Arkansas's premier fun country band, who have three full-length studio albums and a recent EP. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Best Impressions Restaurant in the incredible Arkansas Arts Center in downtown Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, playing for us tonight, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here behind me? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, so tonight's featured artist is Susan Paulson, and our featured pieces are these two pieces, this one here and this one over here, which are both from her Wilmot exhibition, which is here at the Art Center. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and Susan at the Art Center website, arkansasartcenter.org. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all revolve around leaving lasting impressions. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Rick Shumate leaves his mark on an unlikely person, and we'll end the night with Alice Van Treese and a friend making sure that their act of rebellion is noticed. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Mickey Jordan and a man he met briefly but will never forget in Richard Weaver, R.I.P.
Tournament office. Tournament office. Help! The walkie-talkie blurred. This is the tournament office. Mickey, there's a man down out here. He's lying on the ground on the golf course, Marshall reported. Where are you? Between the third green and the fourth tee. I'll be right out. Keep him quiet and wait there so you can help me put him in a golf cart. I called 911, ordered an ambulance, and hastily drove a golf cart to where the man lay. People nearby said he was a caddy. With some help, we placed him in the passenger side of the golf cart, and I drove him back to the clubhouse with me. He was a fit-looking fellow, slender of build, with a bronze complexion, probably acquired many hours out in the sun working as a caddy. He was conscious, although his face was pale and quite weak. I placed wet, cool compresses on his forehead, and he did respond. What's your name? He stared up at me with blurry eyes. Richard Weaver. Where are you from, Richard? Memphis. That's a long way from the coast. What are you doing down here? I'm a tour caddy. I work for a golf professional, and I travel each week to the locations of the tournament. As we spoke, his coloring improved, but his moaning revealed he still had much discomfort. The two professional golf associations, PGMN, assigned to supervise the players were quite alarmed. They urged Richard to take the ambulance and go to a hospital for observation. I will only go to a hospital if he takes me, he said, gesturing to me. As I pull out of the parking lot, I inquired, are you feeling better? Yes, sir. Good, I didn't realize it was so hot today. It's probably not that. I began to sense he might just have a hangover. Oh, out having too much fun last night. We've all done that. Do you have a family? not married. I'm going to take you to Singing River Hospital, which is nearby. Maybe we should go to Ocean Springs Hospital. I was surprised to find he knew the area. I didn't think you knew your way around here. Avoiding my eyes, Richard said, I heard Ocean Springs is a good hospital. He became more talkative. I'm a binge drinker. I fell off the wagon this past weekend. I don't drink all the time, but when I do, I can't stop. Since Stuart, my golfer, didn't make the cut last week, I came here early and had too much time on my hands. He began to cry. I checked myself into Ocean Springs Hospital after drinking for 3 days and nights. I was sorry to hear that. I told him, I have a son, Patrick, who's a recovering alcoholic. He hadn't had a drink now in 6 years. As a matter of fact, he'll be here Thursday. I know he would talk with you. It's tough to stop. No kidding, I don't think I can. Sure you can. I'm certain Patrick didn't think he could stop either. We pulled up to the emergency entrance, and Richard gave a wry smile. How did you know I drink too much? Just a feeling, I guess. A lucky guess. Let's get you taken in here so you can caddy for your pro in the tournament when it starts. As we entered the hospital, a nurse walked by us and said to Richard, we knew you'd be back. I raised my eyebrow and glanced at Richard. I checked myself out, he stated, giving me a sheepish grin. I helped Richard to a seat and went to the admitting window. The man with me is in pretty bad shape. Please get to him as soon as you can. She assured me she would, despite having a waiting room full of people. I walked over to Richard. Now you just wait here till they call you. I have to get back to work. Here's my business card with my telephone number. If you have any questions or problems, feel free to call me, but don't do anything foolish. Don't worry, Mr. Mickey, I'll be okay. I returned to my office. About 45 minutes later, my telephone rang. Tournament director's office. May I speak to Mickey Jordan? This is he. Mr. Jordan, this is Sheriff Joe Walls. Were you in Ocean Springs today with anyone? Yes, I was. Would you describe the person you were with? He wore jeans, a short-sleeved yellow shirt, and sneakers. I say he was in his early 30s. Oh, and he had brown hair. I'm not sure how to tell you this, but the man you described jumped off a bridge onto the interstate and committed suicide a while ago. Oh, my God. Do you know his name? Richard Weaver. The only piece of identification on him was your business card in one of his pants pockets. Mr. Jordan, we need to ask you some questions. Will you be at the country club today? Yes, all day. The PGA men were in a panic. They decided to telephone PGA headquarters in Florida for guidance. Later that day, the sheriff showed up. I told them all that I could recall. The PGA officials provided more biographical details. That afternoon, the pro for whom Richard caddied arrived. When the PGA officials told him what happened, he slumped into a chair. I knew Richard was a recovering binge alcoholic. He said that with tears in his eyes. In fact, he'd been doing quite well recently. We tour players have a non-denominational religious service on Wednesday nights. Lately, Richard has been attending consistently with me. To take his own life must have possessed overwhelming sadness and despair. His inability to cope with his recurring problem became too much. I'll always remember Richard Weaver, a young man whose demons were more than he could bear.
Mickey Jordan resides with his wife, Becky, in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, where he is a member of the Village Writers Club. A graduate from the University of Tennessee, Mickey has won awards from the Hot Springs Fine Arts Center, Springfield, Missouri Writers Guild, Grand Prairie Festival of the Arts, and the White County Creative Writers. His recently published book is entitled Kaleidoscope of Tales. Next on Tales from the South, Rich Shumate doesn't realize it at the time, but he will leave an impression in Adventures in Substitution.
Mr. Shumate, can you help me button my pants? Illyrica had bounded out of the little girl's room, 8 years young, knee-high, all pigtails and Coke bottle glasses, blissfully unaware of why it was totally inappropriate to ask a grown man to help her button her pants. Thinking fast, I suggested she get help from one of the other girls in her class. No, she wailed. They'll think I'm gay. I considered trying to explain to Illyrica how and why what she just said was politically inappropriate on so very many levels. But then I decided that was above my pay grade as a substitute teacher. Finding myself a casualty of the Great Recession, I made my living for an entire semester as a substitute teacher in what is, allegedly, supposedly, one of the finest school districts in Arkansas. This included a 2-week sojourn with Illyrica and her fellow third graders. I knew there was trouble ahead when I noticed one little girl, Destiny, who was not only sitting separately from the rest of her classmates, but had her desk turned around facing the back wall. The boy sitting nearest to Destiny looked at me, pointed at her, and said, "Mister, she's bad." Destiny just grinned slightly, with more malevolence than a third grader ought to possess. Now, what you need to know is when students see a substitute in front of the room, there's a visceral chemical reaction that turns even the most well-behaved student 8 shades of ornery. And we've already established Destiny was not the most well-behaved of students. Needless to say, she didn't disappoint. I sent her to the office. The office sent her back. I sent her to the office again. The office sent her back again. I kept sending her to the office. The office kept sending her back. On my last day there, she drew me a note, as third graders for some reason are wont to do. It was festooned with hearts and read, "Please come back. We love you." Really, I send you to the office 11 times in 2 weeks and you love me? What exactly is it about me that you love? Third grade, I discovered, comes with its own peculiar logic. I was with this particular class for so long because their regular teacher was seriously ill. When the principal came in to tell the students this, a little boy asked, with a slightly frightened tone, "Is she going to die?" The principal was not amused and rebuked him rather sharply. I admit I, too, was a bit taken aback. But once I thought about it, I realized that was a perfectly logical third grade question. That would not be the only question that would leave me taken aback. I was subbing in a freshman English class when the students, noticing I don't have much of an Arkansas drawl, asked me where I was from. "Wyoming," I replied, which prompted one student to ask, "Wyoming? Do they smoke weed there?" Really, you're freshman in high school, confronted with the geographic location with which you are unfamiliar, and that's your very first question? That's the very first thing you want to know? But before I could decide how to answer, another student helpfully piped up, "Dude, they smoke weed everywhere." True enough, though somewhat beside the point. At this point, of course, as you might imagine, I was trying with considerable difficulty not to laugh. You may not be surprised to learn that about 2 weeks later, I had nearly the exact same conversation in a different class. At least this time they were sophomores. These same sophomores were also going on and on about how they were going to the club. "We're going to the club, we're going to the club." I decided to warn them that too much going to the club might result in them being 50 years old and working as a substitute teacher. This priceless wisecrack, alas, went right over their heads, not even a twitter. I took this to mean they couldn't imagine I was actually 50 years old. Glass half full. Being a substitute is nothing if not an adventure in diversity. I taught Chinese. I was the girls' basketball coach. I supervised the dance team, who were some of the most delightfully sassy girls I've ever come across. And I spent the longest hour of my life writing herd over 35 rambunctious middle school boys who made up the brass section of the band. By the time they were through, the room looked like a bomb had gone off. I was supposed to come back to the same school the next day, but with my last good nerve thoroughly worked, I begged off. The secretary in the office had to bribe me to come back with the promise of a gifted and talented class. What you need to understand is that for a substitute teacher, that's the equivalent of an offer of crack. Now, in this particular school district, if you have to send a student to the office, you must fill out what's known as the long form, a checklist containing 54 different infractions, ranging from chewing gum in class to talking back and presumably second-degree murder. These forms are filled out with such frequency that long form has actually become a verb. As in, "If you don't sit down and be quiet, I'm going to long form you." And the classic, "Don't make me have to long form you." I was never quite sure what actually happened after students were sent out with a long form, but the fact they were out of my life was sufficient. My very first long forming came one day in the 6th grade, an age where the girls are often awkwardly larger than the boys. There was one such girl in this class, sitting in the back, surrounded by a group of male miscreants who were apparently teasing her. She started to cry. When I asked her what was wrong, she asked if she could go see the nurse. I let her go, then promptly long-formed the ringleader for infraction number 37, being a general horse's hind end. She came back a bit later, still weepy, and I sat her on the other side of the room by my desk. As she was leaving, I asked again if she was all right. She said, "I'm just so tired of being persecuted." Persecuted, that's the word she used. A sixth grader who feels persecuted in school. I swallowed hard and told her, "You may not believe this now, but things will get better." Then she handed me a drawing she made to thank me, again with the pictures. Now granted, this was February, and the picture she drew was inexplicably of reindeer, but they're very well-drawn reindeer. And I suddenly realized that while I would probably never see her again, she might very well remember me for the rest of her life. And that's just about the most a substitute teacher can hope for. Thank you.
A former news editor at CNN in Atlanta, Rich Shumate is a journalist and writing teacher in Little Rock, Arkansas, and founder of ChickenFriedPolitics.com, a site covering Southern politics. This fall, he starts a journalism PhD program at the University of Florida. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, it's an impact Alice Van Treese is going for and gets in Strom Thurmond's Tea Party.
Mrs. Thurmond was dying. She was sitting in a squeaky Lincoln rocker on the back porch, fanning herself while staring vacantly at the kittens playing on the porch steps. Even when she stood up, her once tall frame was now stooped, and she seemed 2 feet shorter than she had years earlier. At 90, her mind wandered in and out, confusing everyone as to where she was at any particular time. Sometimes she was 13 again. At other times, she was on vacation in Italy. Every now and then, she would regain her senses and recognize somebody, although she usually didn't remember anyone's name. Today was different. "Betsy, how are you, my dear? Have you had a facelift?" Betsy was her daughter. "Alice, you're looking good. You must have a new man in your life. What have you two been up to?" "No good, I bet." Betsy and I, friends for over 50 years, always answered her questions good-naturedly, even making up answers we thought she would like when we didn't know the real answers. We sometimes gave her answers she'd like, even when we knew the right answer. "Who's president now?" "Strom Thurmond." "Strom? That's wonderful. Do you remember the tea party I had for him when he was running for president?" Strom Thurmond had been her late husband's brother. "Yep, sure do," I said all the while thinking. "Remember when you threw us in the yard and said we couldn't stick our fingers into the pettifores? Remember when you said we were too little to go to a big people's party? Remember when you said little girls in South Carolina should..." "Where's my Spidey dog? Have you seen Spidey? He acted so strange at the party. I've always wondered what made him act that way." Betsy and I stared at each other contritely. We knew exactly what had happened to Spidey Dog on that beautiful sunny day. We had kept our guilty secret for 50 years. Strom Thurmond was running for president, and there was a tea party at Mrs. Thurmond's house. It was hot. It was so hot, everyone in Aiken County was walking around in as few clothes as they could without being arrested for indecent exposure. I was invited over to participate in the event, not as a party-goer, but as a companion for Betsy. The tea party was scheduled for 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By 1 o'clock, the kitchen was full of helpers making tiny sandwiches. Loaves of white bread were stacked on the counter, and one helper was cutting off the crust while another took a cookie cutter and cut off the crust. The rounds were then covered with mayonnaise and topped with a slice of cucumber or tomato. Another helper was polishing silver at the sink, while still another was complaining that the cream cheese was still too solid to mix up with mayonnaise and black olives or pineapple pieces. This mixture was also spread on the little rounds of bread. All of the trays of sandwiches were covered with moistened towels to keep the bread soft. Boxes of chocolate candy were kept in the refrigerator so they wouldn't melt from the heat before serving. Best of all, there were boxes and boxes of sweets from the local bakery, pettifores with decorations of pink roses on top, bourbon cookies laden with pecan chips, chocolate-covered pecans and cakes, and there were lots of cakes. They were to be sliced just before the guests began arriving. Betsy and I hung around the kitchen for a long time until someone noticed us eating cheese straws and picking the icing off of a cake. Mrs. Thurman was summoned, and we were quickly relegated to the yard with Spotty Dog. It was too hot to stand in the sun, so we sought out a favorite hiding spot under the rose bush on the right-hand side of the house and waited for the partygoers to arrive. It seemed to take forever. Finally, the first car pulled up. It was a huge black Cadillac sedan. Strom and his first wife, Jean, got out. We wanted to run out and greet them, but remembered Mrs. Thurman's warning us not to bother the guest and stayed safely hidden. "Look at her hat, Betsy. It's huge, huge and black," I said. "Yeah, dummy, it's black because she wants it to match her shoes," Betsy said. "She isn't matching her ugly shoes. She's wearing it because she has to wear a hat to a tea party and white gloves, too." Another car pulled up, and then another, and another. We stopped there squabbling and stared at the procession of women in hats and gloves. Hats, hats, hats. We had never seen as many hats. When the last car was parked and everyone safely inside, we began to sulk. Spotty Dog was sulking too. He just hung around with his tail between his legs and looked sad, as if he were hoping someone would report us to the police for tying him to the rose bush. "It's not fair. Why do we have to stay out here?" Betsy said. "Old people are just mean, that's why. Don't you know anything about old people?" We felt slighted, and the longer we stayed under the rose bush, the more mistreated we felt. We were unwanted, unloved, almost orphans. "I'd let my children come to my party," Betsy said. "Me too. I'd even let them eat all the food they wanted. I'd even invite Spotty. I'd never make him stay outside," I remember saying. We were miserable. We were rejected. We were political prisoners. And within minutes, we began plotting revenge. Neither Betsy nor I remember whose idea it was to let Spotty go to the party, in spite of the admonitions against it. Betsy remembers it was my idea. I remember it was hers. Regardless, we were determined to prepare Spotty for the party. We crept out from under the rose bush and carefully walked around the house, staying close to the foundation bricks, and crawled under the windows so no grown-ups could see us. When we were sure nobody was looking, we ran across the yard to the garage and found the bicycle pump. One of us held Spotty Dog fast. The other inserted the bicycle pump nozzle in his rear end and began pumping him up. Spotty Dog wiggled and tried to get away, but we held fast and kept pumping. When Spotty Dog was full of air, we sneaked back around the house, carried him up the steps to the front porch, opened the door, turned him loose, and ran to the front window to peer in and see what happened. We didn't have to wait long. Spotty Dog ran and farted his way throughout the house, searching for his mistress, Mrs. Thurmond. Some of the ladies held their noses, trying not to look embarrassed. Nobody talked about farting in those days. Others acted as if nothing was happening and continued holding teacups with their pinkies in the air. We looked carefully around the room, but we couldn't see what Strum was doing. By this time, we were laughing so hard, we abandoned our plan to remain undetected. We knocked over one of the porch rockers, causing Mrs. Thurman to head for the porch and the source of the commotion. We saw her coming and ran to hide under the rose bush once again. Betsy scratched her arm on a thorn and wiped the blood on her shirt. I scraped my knee, but other than those mishaps, we returned to our clandestine spot safely. Mrs. Thurman knew exactly where we were hiding. "Do you girls know what is wrong with Spotty Dog?" We didn't dare tell her the truth on that long ago day, but today was different. She was ready for the truth, and we told her. "I should have known," she said, and laughed out loud. She was quiet for a moment, then said, "Where's my Spotty Dog?" She had left us again to visit some other place in her memory bank, but we finally had a clear conscience. We had been absolved of any feeling of guilt over Spotty Dog's behavior at Strom Thurmond's tea party.
Alice Twiggs Van Treese is an author and needlepoint artist residing in Augusta, Georgia. She is the author of one novel, Charlie's Secret, and one children's grandparents' gardening book, The Rabbit in the Moon. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Gave her a ring, well, then I gave her my heart, and that's a pretty good start to a lifetime of love. Well, I gave her a kiss, then I gave her a hug, and now we got the love bug and a lifetime of love. Teach you in school that 1 + 1 = 2, and change the Y to I, but there's exceptions to the rule. And never talk to strangers, and obey the golden rule, and try to pursue a lifetime of love.
Writer accommodations provided by the Baker House Bed and Breakfast. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.